to have you all here tonight. And I think I want everybody close because I want to talk about intimacy. And, what was it, last week or the week before when Kokyo received his fancy robe from Reb? And, Reb being his teacher. And Reb told the story about how, what is it that lies under the robe and intimacy, and what is the business under this robe, intimacy. And then he threw in, and if you are naked, then it's the intimacy of bone, And so I wanted to talk about that because another interesting thing about intimacy, I was reading Aitken Roshi today, and he said, intimacy is a synonym for wisdom in the old texts. So I want to talk about how is it that intimacy that and wisdom, huh? It's the same thing. What does that mean? I also want to talk about when I was up here last, I talked about how we support one another to awaken, that we're all each other's teachers. So I got permission from Dharma Sister to talk somewhat specifically about an ongoing conversation that we've been having as an example of some of the Dharma points that I'm wanting to get to tonight about intimacy, but also as just kind of our own contemporary... could I have water? Someone? Yeah, I just know I'm going to need it. Our own contemporary modern day example of how we help one another awaken. You know, we read the traditional stories about Zhao Zhou and, Chong Yan and all these different, mostly Chinese men, and we try to make it be about us, which we do very well. But what I want to talk about today is actually my own experience, intimate experience with a Dharma companion, which feels to me exactly like those same stories of old and the way that the masters and students of old, helped one another to awaken. So, do you have to go all the way to the kitchen to get water?
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay.
Should I wait?
You know what? Why don't we just do without? And I'll tell you if I need it, because I don't want you to have to be out. And otherwise, I'll just sit here quietly for 3 minutes. So, if I get really dry,
at the end I'll get up and just.
If I get really dry, I'll like go, and then you can go get water. Yeah, so I want to first describe the early part of this Dharma conversation, and that was that we have this lovely little Sunday night discussion group, and so we talk about what we're practicing in our lives, what we're working on, and I made reference to something I was working with, which was from a famous Zen poem, various translations, but basically something like this, flowers in the spring, autumn with the moon, breezes in the summer, winter snow. If useless things do not clutter your mind, then you have the best days of your life. And so I had announced at group that I was working on having no useless thoughts in my mind. And my Dharma sister said, well, what do you mean, no useless thoughts? I thought our practice was that we just accept whatever arises. Aren't you having discriminating mind? Aren't you being discriminating if you're saying, oh, this is a good thought, this is a bad thought, this is a useful thought, this is a useless thought? I thought, well, that's a good point she has. It's true. We do preach, the Dharma of emptiness here, that they're really of non-discrimination. And there I was, being discriminating, saying... And I pushed back. I said, no, darn it. I actually do believe that I think useless thoughts, and I don't want to think them. I actually want to practice not thinking the useless thoughts. She said, well, what are the useless thoughts to you? And I said, well, to me, it's that which would take me away from being able to experience the flowers in the spring, the moon in the autumn, the breezes in the summer, the snow in the winter. That which would have me think, these aren't the best days of my life. I think that's a useless thought. And I want to, work with the kind of Manjushri side of our practice, which is we do try to penetrate and cut through obstructions. We don't just accept everything. There's the side where we do and the side where we don't. So we had this little tussle about it. She's like, oh, I'm not so sure about that, you know? So that was kind of cool. And of course, as with any koan, if this was a teaching story, I'd say, well, who was right? Am I right? Are those useless thoughts? Or is she right that I'm being discriminating about my thoughts and to just be with it? Who's right? You know, isn't that what Zen's about? Isn't it about having the right answer? Isn't it about doing it right? No? Oh. Okay, so that's kind of the first little nudge here. But then, now this is really a crack up to me. Several weeks later, you know how they say in the stories, and then several years later, you know. So several weeks later then, my Dharma sister was inferring that she wished she could improve her practice. She really wanted to be better at some things that she was really working with. And kind of a confession, you know, I could improve my practice and I want to improve my practice in a certain way. And then I said, I don't know actually who said it, I don't know where this came from because I had not premeditated this thought, but I said, I laughed and I said, but this is a useless practice. You know? And it felt really, and then I thought, oh my God, what? Who said that? This is a use, and she looked kind of, useless practice? So, wait a minute, aren't I contradicting what I said before? Here I was, a few weeks before, defending my right to try to banish the useless thoughts from my mind, and here I was telling my companion, oh, this is a useless practice. So, I felt bad when I went home. I thought, oh God, how discouraging that must be to somebody to hear somebody else say, oh, this is a useless practice. And what did I mean by that anyhow? If this is a useless practice, why have I been coming for 20 years? You know, why do I bust my butt on the zafu if I think this is a useless practice? I didn't even quite know what I meant by that, except that it just came out of me to say that. So I thought, well, I'll check in with her and see how she's doing. And I said, you know, I don't mean to be discouraging when I speak like that. And she said, actually, that is exactly what she craves. She said, like a lightning bolt zapping my insides, I bow in gratitude for helping me to open to the very thing that can never be sought. And what that brought up then for me was, it's not about who's right and who's wrong. It's not about useless or not useless. It's about meeting each other deeply in our deepest questions. That's the practice. And sometimes it'll be on one side and sometimes it'll be on the other side. Both are true. Yes, I do want to learn over time how to appreciate the moment and discourage the thoughts that arise in me that keep me from the moment, the useless thoughts. And ultimately, it is a useless practice. If we're practicing to attain something, to try to get somewhere, forget it. There's no guarantee. Is that depressing? Or is that liberating? You know, and if it's liberating, why is it liberating? Because we answered the question? I don't think so. I think it's because we meet in our truth and struggle together. And that, I believe, is intimacy. I think that's part of what is being meant by intimacy. Aitken Roshi, recently departed, says it's a synonym for wisdom. This method of working with apparent contradiction is actually one of the most kind of tried and true Zen methods. You know, whether we're looking in the studying, you know, there's always this positing of things that feel like opposites, and then we struggle with that. We go, how can this be? How can it be? You know? I mean, we could take any of our favorite stories and we could look at them as this positing of grappling with apparent opposites, with apparent paradox. Useless thoughts, no useless thoughts. What do you mean? I want to get better, but it's useless. Why do it? That was Dogen's question. You know, Dogen's question, if we're already enlightened, why bother practicing? This is the founder of our school, the source of so many powerful teachings and his whole life. He had that question. Why even bother practicing if you're already enlightened? So it wasn't about answering the question. It was this intimacy of bringing forth his being and meeting the beings that were around him and how we meet him through time. Intimacy. My mom, I talked quite a bit during the time when she was dying, when I was taking care of her, which was a couple years ago. And she had this koan of the seemingly irreconcilable situation. Her koan was, how can I die when I still like to eat so much? You know, her body was kind of beginning to fail her. It was failing her. She was sick a lot. She couldn't get out of bed. She didn't have any energy, but she still loved to eat. She ate with gusto. That was our pleasure. I would go up and cook, and she would eat it, and I cooked her stew and cake, and you know, oh, and she ate it, and she smacked her lips, and she ate a lot of it, and you know, the hospice nurse would come, and they'd kind of tiptoe in the room. How are you doing? You know, how's your appetite? Oh, great, she'd say, you know, just fully living as she was dying. But that was a koan for her, and she'd press me about that. How can I die when I love to eat so much, and I love you all so much? I love you. As if she had to stop loving what she loved in order to die. She grappled with that. She grappled with that until a week before she died. She was still grappling with it. She was still loving and eating and feeling like, I need to die, but I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to do this. Which is true, you know? In fact, that was one of the themes of one of my talks about the experience, was that koan, dead or alive, I will not say, I will not say. You know, that's another one of the, again, many, many, many koans that seem to be about contradiction, you know. The monk is raps on the coffin at his Dharma brother's funeral, you know. Dead or alive, I will not say, I will not say. So, you know, there was my mom. How can I die when I love to eat and I love you all so much? But you know what? She solved her koan. I don't know how she solved her koan, because I can't ask her anymore, because she solved her koan by letting herself die. Apparently, she solved it. 1 week before she took her last breath, she just curled up in a little ball, and I said, okay, Mama, I got to make you dinner now. You know, I'm going to be leaving. And you know, once I go, Francis comes home from work. He's tired. This is your last chance to have dinner. I'm leaving. No, it's okay. You sure? Yeah. You know? And that was it. That was it. Next day, you want some food? No. No. You okay? Yeah, I'm okay. She figured it out. She figured it out. And I don't know how, but she did. The universe is vast and wide. Why do I put on my seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell? There it is again. The same, you know, teaching. How can this be? There's so many possibilities in the world. It's infinite. How can I do one thing? Why should I do one thing? How do I know what to do if it's so vast and wide? That's the teach. That's the practice, I believe. That's the practice. And sometimes the contradiction teaches us by pushing us. You know, it's like the tension of it. And something snaps. Or sometimes it may feel gracious and beautiful and holy. But that holding of the tension is the practice of the bodhisattva. That is where the bodhisattva lives, is in that very place. Because when you think about the bodhisattva vows, that's there again, you know, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. But wait a minute, I can't save them, they're endless. Yeah, it's endless, and I vow to do it. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Yep, my mind is always going to be dividing, it's always going to be separating, it's always going to be judging. You know, it's always going to be generating this delusional, you know, thought that we're separate. It's endless. Those delusions are endless, and I vow to end them. You know, that's the bodhisattva vow. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. You know, all these learning opportunities. I don't want any more learning opportunities. But I still vow to open to them when I can. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. So right there in the vows of the bodhisattva, of the beings who are living to enlighten others and for the enlightenment of others and to awaken with others. It's not bodhisattva here, beings there, I am going to be, you know, I'm going to put off my enlightenment until you're enlightened. It's more like, you know, my practice is to wake up with you, not separate from you, with you. As long as it takes. And we all know how long it's going to take. Forever. You know. So that's either like terrifying and get me out of here, or it's actually probably both. You know, here I am setting up another dichotomy. Or it's profoundly liberating. Because then you're free. It's not dependent upon what happens. Your vow is where you live from. And it doesn't have to look a certain way out there in order for you to move from and come from and be in your vow. So living with that tension and with that paradox, it's kind of like, maybe, I don't know what your experience is when you find yourself able to do that. I know I can't always do it, but sometimes I can. It's sort of like riding a wave, you know, or just being carried by something that I could resist or I could let it flow through me. One teacher talks about the not being stopped by the seeming barrier of the paradox as the as actually a source of vitality. That place of tension within the contradiction that doesn't need the contradiction to resolve itself as a source of vitality. Because then again, we're free. We're free. So intimacy, meeting each other, supporting each other with the questions of our lives, bringing our questions, trusting each other enough to bring our questions to each other and to stick with each other. Like the story that I told here some weeks ago, the awakening of someone who ended up being, I'm really bad with names, I don't remember his name. Well, his Japanese name is Seppo. Yeah, I don't remember his Chinese name, which is the one I talked about. But, you know, for most of his life, he was described of as a kind of a failed student, you know. But he kept at it. He kept trying, and he had a faithful friend. And it was really his faithful friend who helped him have the kind of awakening that gave him the courage to go forward. So this is what we can do for one another over time together. Putting out these things that seem like contradictions, that seem like opposites, but that are what? I don't know. I have no idea what time it is, but I would love to hear some of what's coming up for you as I'm talking. Like I told Jean when I left the house, I said, this is probably one of the most unplanned talks that I've ever had the guts to come up here. usually have kind of, I kind of have a little strategy, but I just thought, I just want to go into this material and then see what happens. So join me in not knowing here. Yeah.
Would you please say a little more about the idea of vitality being present in when one resides in the apparent contradiction?
Yeah.
And is that related to intimacy?
Well, I think that with the thing of the feeling of the paradox, that the pull of the paradox is that it's like we're supposed to have an answer, or we're supposed to resolve something, we're supposed to take a side, we're supposed to know. And so I think that, thank you, there's a way that being in that, being caught by that, we're closing ourselves off to, like if I'm caught, if there's A position and B position, and I am really identified with the A position, and my thoughts are about reinforcing the A position, there's a whole universe of B, let alone C, D, E, F, and G, that I'm not open to. I'm not open to be influenced by. So I think part of the vitality that comes from not needing A to mean that B is canceled out, that the vitality from that is this openness to whatever is arising. Everything becomes the practice field, being actualized by the myriad things. I think that's what Dogen means. Everything becomes the everything is a Dharma gate. Everything is an opportunity for awakening if I'm open to it and not closing and fixing. So to me, that is the ultimate intimacy, is to be able to stand and be with the world and receive the world in whatever form it's coming, and to participate with it from this open posture, you know, rather than protecting and judging and pushing away and thereby limiting my contact, you know.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, what's your experience?
Oh, well, I'm very much in accord with what you just said, and I'm amused because something just came to mind that follows on from Patrick's talk a few weeks ago. Since then, I've been to New York City, spent a week there, thought of some of the...
With the bodhisattvas.
The bodhisattvas. And as you were speaking just now, Kathy, the image of the subway in which we sit together in all of our apparent differences and sometimes even worries or whatever, but we are there in some strangely intimate relation to each other, just came to my mind again because of a vivid encounter in the subway, so that, which could have appeared to be a worrisome moment, but wasn't, because if you can meet these events in the manner that you just described, and there's an intimacy.
Yeah. Everything is possible. But then, of course, there's always, you know, the other side. I mean, you know, this is sort of the, you know, there's difference and unity. And so there's this feeling and this experience of oneness and intimacy and being connected. And then there, it's also true that there is differentiation, and sometimes we do need to protect ourselves, and sometimes we do need to have boundaries, and sometimes we do need to have positions. You know, like when you're fighting for political things, when you're trying to get something to happen. You know, we were having some conversations about, you know, you, in your community, you, there's things you care about, and yeah, you do. You don't just go, well, whatever. You say, no, I don't want that to happen. You know, or I do want this to happen. And that's part of it. It's not this, you know, mush land. But there's a certain kind of a, oh, I think vitality is, I mean, I think that is a good word, because even in difference, I think you can still experience that feeling of vitality and unity. You know, I mean, even in the middle of a difficult confrontation or making something happen, I mean, this is something, you know, we talk about in the discussion group often, is, but what about those places where you do need to put your foot down or something? Well, you know, I think you can still do it with a sense of intimacy. I don't know. What do you think about that? Can you do that? I mean, I think what really hurts my heart most in the world, and when I'm, you know, I work with groups, and when I see people doing this, is when people feel like the differences, and sometimes the necessary differences, means that we have to make each other into enemies and objects and hate one another. You know, can you strongly disagree with somebody and yet not hate them? Can you, you know, still be strong in your action and recognize that in some way I am completely connected with you? Yeah, Shaho.
Well, I'm thinking of Gandhi when he was shot. He said, "Don't worry, we are still connected," right, to the person shooting him, and that always inspired me very much. I was just also picking up on kind of going with what you're pointing out right now. It sounded to me like you're saying intimacy is to the dichotomy, and you kind of find a way beyond it, like your mom, like there's an overarching, all-inclusive something that you, like this thing with a box, and you can connect all the points because you go outside, kind of like this kind of solid thing.
Mm-hmm.
But though I wonder where the self-centeredness in that thing, because you keep saying there's still the self who is like doing it, but in a way that's like the beauty and the wisdom of the teaching is like, well, it's larger. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's
why one of my very favorite and most, I think, most helpful formulations is Dogen's "To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. And then when actualized by the myriad things, body and mind of self and other drop away. And this no trace continues endlessly." I love that teaching because it includes self. There is a self. But the purpose of studying the self is to forget the self and be actualized by the myriad things. So in a way, it's saying it's you know, there's a function. You know, all things have their function. There is a function for even small self. And I think our teaching, the teaching that we're working to understand, is that that is maybe nested in bigger self. You know, both exist, and yet there's a dimensionality to it of, you know, self isn't a separate thing. It's a function of a bigger system. You know, and I think that's where we get in trouble when we box off self and get oppositional, is we forget that, you know, if your little box is here and my little box is here, there's all sorts of ways that we're connected, and that you can study that in history or in group dynamics, where you can see that there's infinite ways that we impact one another and we're connected even if we think we're separate.
So
go ahead, and then I'll
I just in that context, then, when if you would have kept sitting on the end of the room today, it would have been, would it have just altered yourself? Would it have just made a different self to us? I'm just saying that in the dynamic, it still doesn't release up of the responsibility to hold the self very, like you said, openly or lightly, because even so, everything that's coming up is legitimately part of the big function, this big function. We don't, so long we don't really know it, we can't really say whatever I'm thinking or whatever I'm doing has to be right or whatever.
Right. And it has its function. Yeah, it has its function. And it's not about watering down that function. You know, I mean, that's just, you know, like the beauty of how individual we all are, even though we have this unity and this intention of unity in our practice. I mean, if you look around the room, you know, and I mean, every single person here has a very, you know, unique and particular taste, you know, to how each of us shows up. And I think that's part of the treasure. Yeah. Patrick?
How are you working with putting down frivolous thoughts?
Oh, back to the original question. You know, that I'm still working with that, and I'm still committed to doing it. Well, because I think that there are habits of mind that we get into that aren't helpful. And it's true, I will completely agree here, that it can become unhelpful to be overly judgmental about one's faults. You know, I mean, I am this one, you know, I am this deluded one, and I treasure her, you know, and there's ways that, you know, I'm always going to be that one, and I don't want to make it sound like, oh, I'll only be there when that one is tamed or better behaved, because she may never be. You know, I may that may always be there. You know, so that is true. And I do think that, you know, part of studying the self is, you know, becoming aware of our habits of mind. And I've been studying the paramitas, and I find that very helpful, because, and I was studying Sila, I see it both ways. Help.
Sheila
is the proper, yeah, and it's interesting, because that's usually been translated, that I've heard, as, you know, as morality, and particularly as defined by the precepts, you know, the Buddhist precepts, which is, okay, that's fine, but there's also, you know, it's going to be kind of, well, what about, is there some essential aspect to Sheila? And I really liked it, I forget who's, I think it was Aiken again, yeah, I've been reading his book, Aiken Roshi's book, the something about the paramitas, the perfections.
Practicing the perfections.
Yeah, which in and of itself, I mean, I was never interested in reading that, because I went, well, that's obviously not me, because I'm so imperfect, but I've since learned that that's probably not the best translation for paramita. You know, paramitas really, they're the vehicles that allow us to support and awaken with all beings and cross over to the other shore. They're vehicles, right? So, part of Sheila, according to Aiken, and I agree with this, is, you know, recognizing that because of the limitations of our characters and our personalities, we do need to engage in self-study and self-improvement, you know, which is, maybe that's different from some of the Zen teaching we hear of, you know, no gaining idea, no improvement. But even Suzuki Roshi says, you're perfect just the way you are, and you could use a little improvement. You know, so even there, I think there's this sense of, well, okay, yeah, and? So, yeah, I'm still, I think it's a valuable, for this one, it's a very valuable practice to look at the ways that I let the static of my habitual thoughts separate me from the gift and the treasure of the world, so that I could literally be sitting, as I often am, in paradise, which exists in my backyard. That is paradise. It's a place. And I can sit there and not see a thing. I can sit there and not see a thing. None of the flowers that I've carefully tended, you know, there, it's like I'm completely carried away with, I would assert, useless thoughts. So, yeah.
Things that came to mind as you were speaking for me, for one, talking about useless thoughts, as I've observed my own mind and things that happened for me, it's occurred to me that useless thoughts or thoughts that I consider unhelpful isn't so much the problem, because thoughts, they just arise unbidden. They just come and come and come. But I found that for me, one of the big things that I've had to look at is more the conversations that I have with myself, more along the lines of useless talk toward myself. That's really where it is. The point at which I can choose to say, well, I've had that thought, and I've had this thought a lot before, and I don't really find it all that helpful, so maybe it'll help some other time. Never know, but I don't really want it right now, thanks. And so that's one thing that came to mind. And another was talking about sitting with a paradox and how that relates to intimacy. I've been finding recently that both what makes it most difficult for me to see other people in an intimate way and what really hurts me the most when I'm trying to be intimate with someone is the inability to sit with the paradox of what someone is. You know, there are very very clear examples of all of this in one particular relationship in my life where, you know, someone has a bit of a hard time just engaging with some of the paradoxes that are just inherent in who I am and how my life goes. You know, she was trying very hard to figure out which box I fit in, or preferably to decide which box I fit in, and it just doesn't work because there's some of both going on there. And that's something that I've even had imprinted on me because this is someone who's been in my family all my life. And so I even struggle sometimes with, well, you know, I'm white, but I'm Native American at the same time. I'm a woman, and yet I have very strong male energy at the same time. I'm a Christian, and yet I'm very interested in Zen and doing all these other things. And that's all right, and it takes a lot of work to sit with that paradox. And at the same time, I know that sometimes I box other people in with all the best intentions in the world, but I still mess up because I'm like, oh, you're like this, this is so wonderful. And it's like, well, it's not always that wonderful because it's not always that way. Oh, yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's so much in what you're saying. I do think I agree with you. I think that's very helpful, your first point about it isn't so much the thought, it's what we do with it. Yeah, because obviously the thought is just, it's just a thought. Yeah, it's just a bubble. It's just a, it's okay. It's what am I doing with that thought? Yeah, and the paying attention to that. Yeah, and the other thing you're saying that I think I really relate to is that, yeah, the difficulty with being with it is, I think it really is that there's, how should I say this? Like, I wonder sometimes, why are some people that other people think are difficult? I have no problem being with that person. It's just, yeah, I see those aspects of them, but okay, you know, ducks quack, dogs bark, cats meow, roosters crow, you know, people, some people are this way, some people are that way, some people are loud, some people are quiet, some people tend to get angry, some people get withdrawn, some people are happy, you know, and then other people, I'm just, it's like, I feel like I have ants crawling all over my body, and I don't want to be with that person, and what is that, you know, but again, putting the focus, and I think this is kind of the Sheila aspect on not having it be about them, but it's really about me. And, you know, what would it take for me to open to the paradox? What would it take for me to open that Dharma gate? What would it take for me to enter that Dharma gate of being fully with this too? Now, of course, I'm thinking about all the notes that I wish I brought because I'm accessing in my head this haiku. It was in the Paramita book. Okay, I can probably remember. It was an example of, the paramita of shanti, which is often translated as forbearance, which is really what we were just talking about, the ability to be with something that feels difficult. That's the paramita, that shanti paramita, right? So the example, again, this is an Aiken's book. I just happen to be studying it right now, so I'm promoting it. He quotes this poem that Basho wrote. And if I had it, I would read it to you, but I don't. And it's something like he was staying in a stable. And it's kind of something like, lots of jumping fleas, horse pissing by my head, right? You know, and he gave it as this example of, Basho, he probably was uncomfortable. He probably didn't like, wasn't enjoying the fleas and the horse and everything. But, he writes this haiku. It's like, and this too. That was Aiken's point. And this too. That's shanti paramita. And this too. So fill in the blanks for whatever irritates you or me, Fleas and being in a stable with a horse pissing by my head I'd probably be like really, anxious and angry or whatever about that. But what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And this too, Yes.
Do you happen to remember precisely at the moment when you said useless practice, what you were thinking?
What are you referring to?
When you said this is a useless practice.
Oh, right. What the instigating or what?
Yeah.
Well, my experience was that that there was this I know what it was. I know what it was. It was I should be better by now because I've been practicing. I've been doing all this practice. How come I'm not getting better? It was some version of that, which I know really, really well. So in a way, I think part of me that said that was I was speaking as much to myself as to the other, because I have confessed that many times from here and any other of the places where I hang out in this place is, shouldn't I be better by now if I've been, doing this thing? What's the purpose of this practice if it's not going to make me better? So that's kind of that liberative. It's useless.
Well, what it makes me think of is, useless. What does she mean by useless? Mm-hmm. You can't make use of it. Okay, that makes sense. Zazen is not to use for something.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So I know what she's gonna. I know what she's gonna say. She's gonna say that we're just doing zazen is an expression of our Buddha nature, so there's no use in there, but it's beneficial, but it's just not useful, right?
Yeah, well, that's another way to think about it. Yeah. I think that's true as well.
And so, with this other part that you were talking about, that poem, the winter, spring, summer, fall, that there's, in summer there's traffic, in fall there's mud, in winter there's heating bills, and in spring we have mold.
So please finish the poem for us then.
I can't remember the poem, but it just so that we don't attach ourselves to those things that we say, well, this is classic spring, summer, winter, fall.
That's beautiful.
And we're just saying it to balance it out so that we don't always go one direction.
No, that's true, and that's part of the paradox here, and I confess, even when I'm trying to be non-dualistic, I go to dualism, and so, here I am responding to Patrick's question about, I can be sitting in paradise and missing it because of what I think are useless thoughts, as if then what? The right thing to do is to be sitting and smelling my flowers, right? That's the right answer. And then it's like, but then your poem, pulls the rug out from under that. Because that's true. It's true. You know, winter is, you know, dark at 5:30. You know, I mean, I could make my own version of the mud and the mold and the, you know. You know, in Tassajara, oh, I want to go to Tassajara, it's so beautiful. You know, spring is mosquitoes, summer is flies, you know. But there we are. This is our life. This is our life. This is our world, you know. And that's intimacy to me, is to know that, you know, to know that, to feel that together. And sometimes it's sad and sometimes it's happy, you know. But ultimately, it's, you know, it's all just turning. It's also time for tea and cookies. So I'm going to, unless there's one more thing, if anybody wants to say anything else, there's like a few more minutes, and then we can, those who wish, go next door and have tea and cookies, and I'll have water. Charlie.
So I've been working with paradoxes, and I was a mathematician, so I like to exhaust things logically. So getting to winter is snow and heating bills. Every time that comes up, I just go, winter is snow, winter is heating bills. Winter is both snow and heating bills. Winter is neither snow nor heating bills. And I don't know if it's helpful, but I've been doing it a lot lately.
It's very zen.
Yeah, yeah. And it kind of expands it past our 3D way of looking at things.
Right on, yeah. It's both, it's neither. No, it's this, it's that. It's neither this or that. It's both this or that. And it's beyond this or that. Is
well,
sort of the
beyond
five
beyond.
Ranks. Let's see, that's total, that's classic Zen.
Yeah. Anyway, that's how I've been dealing with paradoxes. And it seems to expand things.
Awesome. Thank you. Okay. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible.